On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
The word genius gets tossed around a lot, and sometimes people use it rather easily. But I think today, the subject of our book is somebody who really could be considered in that very rarefied position of being a genius. In her case, a musical genius, and not only a great musician, but a great role model. We're talking about Sarah Vaughan. Our guest today is Dr. Elaine Hayes, the expert on Sarah Vaughan within the music history community. She serves as editor of Earshot Jazz. Her new book is Queen of Bebop, The Musical Lives of Sarah Vaughan. It's from Echo, that's E-C-C-O, which is an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. And Elaine, thank you so much for making time to be with us on the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you for having me.
A very comprehensive book about Sarah Vaughan. You did an awful lot of research. I can see why you are considered to be the expert on her. When you became a fan of hers when you were in college, right?
When I was a kid, we listened almost exclusively to classical music. And in fact, I played classical piano and classical viola. And I really hadn't had that much exposure to jazz until college, when one of my roommates, she would play Sarah Vaughan all the time. And I have to say that I almost immediately fell in love with Sarah's voice. I love the way it sounded. It's just a beautiful voice. And I really admired what she would do with it, how she could swoop from the bottom of her range all the way up to the top. And then she would do these cascade of arpeggios down again. I loved how she would infuse her voice with dissonance, this beautiful harmonic palette. And as a classical musician, I was really impressed with her ability to improvise. I was also really drawn to what I would call her presence while performing. When I would listen to Sarah sing, I heard a woman who was strong and confident, clearly a master of her craft. And as a young woman, still in college myself, still trying to figure out where I wanted to fit into the world, these were values and attributes that I really valued. So I just kept on listening. I listened to other jazz singers. And then a couple years later, when I was in graduate school, I had an opportunity to do some more research on Sarah Vaughan, and I grabbed it. And this project kind of started there, and many years later, we now have Queen of Bebop.
Well, the very fact that you are a classically trained musician who fell in love with her voice really says a lot about the incredible kind of skill and talent that she had. That she had a 4-octave range, that she almost instinctively, it seemed, to be able to figure out how to make a song her own. You have a story in the book about an audition that she was going to do, and she was going to sing a song that was one that had been very popular, and it seemed like she was making, I think the way you put it, making the amateur's mistake as a singer of choosing a song that you like because you like it, but everybody else knows it too. So if you don't sing it the way they are expecting to hear it, they're not going to like you no matter how well you do with it. It's kind of like,
You
never audition with the Star Spangled Banner because everybody knows that.
And it's a hard song.
Yeah, and it's a hard song to sing. So you're just setting yourself up for trouble. And that's what she did, but she took the song and did it so magnificently, Body and Soul, right? Wonderful. It's one of the real jazz classics. I've heard the version that you were alluding to in here that the original performers used, how they sounded on it, and it was terrific. But then I went back, and through the miracle of YouTube, I went back and heard Sarah sing it after I read this passage, and I thought, oh, now I see that she really did wreck the room. There wouldn't be any following that act. Just close the curtain, everybody go home.
Yeah, the performance you're describing actually is her breakthrough performance at the amateur, the Apollo Theater's Amateur Hour, and that audience, aside from her singing this really well-known tune, that audience was notoriously opinionated and ruckus.
Right.
And as the MC of the amateur night at Apollo, Ralph Cooper, would say, he was very worried for Sarah during that performance because, in addition to being really young and looking even younger, she was singing Body and Soul. And he said that the audience, they knew that song so well that they would have been able to sing in harmony along with her while booing her off stage. But like you said, she nailed it. She really rose to the occasion, and she sang that song in a way that no one had heard before. And that's one of the things that really did make her so exceptional, is that while a lot of singers, her contemporaries, were maybe trying to sound like Billie Holiday or even Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah, early on, even when she was 13, 14, 15, was already committed to sounding like herself, being a unique vocalist in her own right.
She certainly was that. And there were a few people that figured that out early on, that this was an incredible talent that was among them, and they needed, she needed to be heard. I love the passages where you talk about her early band days with Billy Eckstine and traveling on the road. She was, interestingly enough, here's this tiny, dainty woman who is not classically gorgeous, but she has this incredible instrument that's built into her, and she has learned how to use it. She has been singing in choir and playing the piano, and that's a good combination. I will say, playing the piano really does help you play every other instrument and as well as sing. It just puts things in your head that you need to have in your head if you're a musician.
Yeah, early on she played in her high school choirs, and before that she played organ and accompanied her church choirs. And she would often say later in her career that thanks to those experiences, she really learned how to take a piece of music apart and then kind of put it back together again. It gave her a lot of technical skills that many vocalists and, quite frankly, many other instrumentalists often do not have. And that's one of the things that set her apart. For better or worse, vocalists, especially girl singers, were often perceived as not being great musicians or not having the intellectual ability to create excellent jazz, which is a stereotype that is certainly not true. But Sarah Vaughan came with a skill set that many musicians simply didn't have. In fact, when she joined Earl Hines' band, Billy Eckstine said she came equipped. And then she was able to keep up, you know, these Earl Hines band, the Billy Eckstine band, these were actually kind of incubators for this new kind of jazz called bebop. And her colleagues were Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, Billy Eckstine, all of these greats of bebop.
Wow.
And she was able musically to keep up with them. And often, I would argue, set the pace for what they were doing as well. And a lot of that had to do with her experience with the piano, but then her ability to translate that into her just very agile musical mind.
Yeah, and we can't emphasize enough that this is a singer who had such incredible control over her instrument that she could she could pick up on a line, say, that Dizzy Gillespie or Bird Parker, who just threw a million notes out there, and she could catch on to what they were going, go with them, do harmony licks with them while they're doing so. In a sense, she's scatting like which is essentially playing an instrument with your voice, and playing along with these guys and keeping up with them, and like you said, leading them. Sometimes she led the group, sometimes they led it, and she came along. And there are very, very few singers who are capable, who have the control and the mastery of their instrument to be able to do that.
It's a once in a, I don't want to say even generation, maybe every two or three generations, a combination of a vocal instrument along with the musical mind, the brilliance to meld all those things. That doesn't happen very often.
No, that's the truth. These are people that do not have to play with anybody they don't want to play with. They're good enough. They're all, even when they're first starting out, they're so good that they can be pretty choosy about who they associate with musically. And they see Sarah as one of their own. They appreciate her musicality. They realize that she's not just the glamour puss that's standing in front of the band to attract attention while they're playing, that this is a musician's musician.
Yes, indeed.
In case you're just joining us, we're talking to Elaine Hayes, who's the author of Queen of Bebop, The Musical Lives of Sarah Vaughan. It's from Echo, ECCO, which is an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Just came out last month. Another side of this, not only do we see her musical progression, we see her struggles with record companies as jazz changes, as bebop takes jazz in a different direction, not so much of a populist direction, not a functional like dance bands. Dance bands had a job. Their job was to play so people could dance to it. Bebop's not that way. It is intellectual. It is esoteric, and that automatically means that it's not going to be a broad appeal. And at the same time, music is changing because we're seeing the transition not only from the big band era but and into the era of vocalists, but also that we're there, the beginning of that pop era that preceded rock and roll and then was shaped by rock and roll. She's singing through all of this and dealing with how labels don't know what to do with her for a lot of the time.
Yeah, so her career was 47 years long, and you did an excellent job of kind of summing up through all these kind of musical moments that her career went through and the different kinds of career ups and downs she had to navigate. Like you said, we did swing to bebop, you know, in the 50s, early 60s, jazz is huge. But by the end of the 60s, rock and roll is king, and jazz musicians are really struggling. And there was actually a time in the late 60s into the 70s, 1967 to 1971, for almost 5 years, when Sarah Vaughan did not have a contract with a record company. And she, you know, she just, that could have been a killer for many careers, but yeah. She kept on singing, kept on going. And one of the things that I think that helped her get through all of this is that she had a very clear understanding of who she wanted to be as an artist. The music industry was constantly changing, and yes, she did do a fair amount of pop music and trendy, like she did her fair share of pop music that was in vogue at, you know, specific moments, but at the center of that, she had an idea of how she wanted to sing, and she kept on doing that, and eventually by the mid-70s, the audience had found its way back to her.
I think that's one of the loveliest things, that here's this wonderful talent, and for a while, nobody knows exactly what to do with her. The people who get her are still want to hear her sing, and they feel bad when she's kind of forced, in order to eat, to do records that they know are really kind of too easy for her, that aren't challenging for her musically. But,
yes.
You know, you've got to do what you got to do, and for a while, got to be one of the oddest pairings in in pop music history, Mitch Miller as the producer for an album of hers, with his wildly inappropriate suggestions about the type of music that she should sing, just some horrible fake Trinidad stuff and ugh.
Yeah. Well, so you're pinpointing one of the kind of moments in popular music. In 1949, she signed with Columbia. It was her first major first contract with one of the big major labels. It's a really big deal.
Right.
And at first, they have her singing a lot of beautiful romantic ballads, which she really excels at. But in 1950, Mitch Miller comes along, and he's a wunderkind producer who has this idea that I'm going to revolutionize pop music by doing what was really blatantly commercial novelty songs. So, music that has a lot of gimmicks in it. It could be technology, it could be dogs barking, it could be weird-sounding instruments, or lots of times kind of ethnic or racially coded music. And mm-hmm. The song you were mentioning, the Trinidadian one, the Gas Pipe She Be Leakin' Joe, is really, it's a calypso. He's forcing her to sing with a faux, this really weird Caribbean accent. There's a big boy choir in the background, this brassy big band, and you can tell she just hated singing it because she really phones in this conversation. She's singing out of tune, she's missing her cues, she's stifling a laugh, just because she really did not want to sing this music that was, she deemed, terrible. And also, I would imagine she did not like the way that it was portraying, a black Caribbean experience. I think that Sarah Vaughan was someone who is very aware of how she, a black woman, and a black artist, was representing herself and how race was being represented.
One of the things that's really sad about the book is so many horrible stories about what it was like to be this premier musician, acclaimed, and when you go from place to place, there's not a decent motel for you to stay in. Or if you're going to buy clothes to perform in, clothes you have to buy them without trying them on. Because if you try them on and don't buy them, then white people aren't going to buy them.
She, like so many of her contemporaries, especially when touring the South, but also she's very explicit that she experienced an enormous amount of racism in the North as well. There's kind of this de facto Jim Crow racism going on in the South and in a more veiled way in the North. That was a part of their reality in their life, that they were often put in very difficult situations and not treated with the respect that they thought they deserved.
Talking about songs, I remember meeting a fellow named Leroy Van Dyke, and he told me that one of the key things about being a singer is never record a song you hate, because sure as it's the one you can't stand singing, it'll become the hit, and you have to sing it the rest of your life. And when I was reading Queen of Bebop, and I ran into this song that she recorded that she really didn't particularly care for, and it ended up being a big pop hit for her. And she, and she ends up having to sing the dumb thing until finally she just tells people, please don't make me, please don't request this song anymore. I don't want to ever have to sing this song again.
I think you're talking about her biggest hit of her career, Broken Hearted Melody from 1959. Yeah, it's another one of those instances where a producer said, hey, you need a hit. You're going to record this. So she does. And they don't release it for about 18 months, and then suddenly it's released, and it becomes the biggest hit of her career, and she has to sing it all of the time.
Right.
And it's constantly, even though it was released in 1959, musicians from the 70s were telling me stories about how the song was still being requested and how she would do everything possible to try to get out of singing it. But one of the silver linings that to come out of that is that it was that song and probably some other ones like it. It was one of those moments where she was like, I need to get more discriminating about what I choose to record, because you can be, like you're saying, you can be stuck with a career for decades, and she didn't want to do that. So to the 60s, especially in the 70s, she just gets much pickier about what she wants to do.
The latter part of her career, she finally gets the opportunity to sing with orchestras and to sing great songs. I mean, she's singing Gershwin. You can hardly find anybody who is a better writer than Gershwin was. And she's singing these magnificent songs with symphony orchestras. She's being essentially almost like a classical musician, which at the very beginning of her career, she really idolized Marian Anderson, for example, the first African-American woman to be a huge success in opera.
Yes. Yeah, that really was one of her goals when she was a small kid. And she came from a church family. So her parents weren't super thrilled when she decided to become a pop and jazz singer. They would have been thrilled had she become an opera singer. But really, she came from a poor family, and she was black. And her family didn't have a lot of connections. And becoming an opera singer really wasn't something, an opportunity that was available to her. But like you said, starting in 1974, she collaborated with the classical conductor and pianist Michael Tilton Thomas, and together they developed this All Gershwin program. And then for the rest of her career, she sang with symphony orchestras across the country, and it really became this opportunity for her to kind of explore that operatic side of her voice and her aspirations to be an opera singer, but really on her own terms. When you think about what an opera singer does, they're a classical musician, and while there's lots of room for musical expression and your own interpretation, you still are beholden to this musical score.
Yeah.
But in jazz, Sarah Vaughan can take a Gershwin song like The Man I Love, and she can recompose it, she can make it into something completely her own. So These Gershwin concerts really were just these beautiful opportunities for her to bring her operatic voice to a new audience that might not have heard her before, like classical music audiences, expose them to jazz, all while doing it all on her own terms.
One of the great things about improvisation is that, to a certain extent, when you're creating a new song, you're making a new song, you are inventing a new melody to previously existing chord structure. That's one of the most fun things about improvisation, and she was maybe the best vocal improviser ever. Even Ella Fitzgerald, who was terrific, couldn't do as much, didn't have quite as much control and beauty of her tone as Sarah Vaughan did.
Yeah, I love Ella Fitzgerald too, although Sarah's my favorite. In my mind, they were both brilliant, but they did their improvisations in different ways. Like, while Sarah was the queen of the slow romantic ballad, because she had this phenomenal voice, she could sing things really, really slowly, which is incredibly difficult. Ella is a master of the up-tempo rhythm numbers and just scatting for 10, 20, 30 minutes. Sarah wasn't quite as good at that. So they both had their own specialties, but I'm still inclined to agree with you. Sarah's my favorite.
Yeah. You tell a great story. Now, I'll be right up front with you about this. I'm not a huge fan of Lyndon Johnson. I've read some really scathing biographies of the man, and I know he was a pretty corrupt guy. Maybe the most corrupt president we ever had, although you never know. But there is a wonderful thing that happens when she's invited to sing at the White House. And it's the occasion of the Japanese Prime Minister, I think it is. It's coming. It's a big state dinner, and they invite her to sing. And, she wows them. And then afterwards, there's dancing, and the president, giant Lyndon Johnson, walks up to little tiny Sarah Vaughan and asks to dance with her. And I am thinking when that happened that everything changed immediately.
Well, so this was in January of 1965. And for Sarah Vaughan, it's my sense that she talked about that evening and dancing with Lyndon Johnson for many years, and how afterwards, after they've danced together, Lyndon Johnson's social secretary, she's looking around for Sarah Vaughan to help her with something, and they can't find her. Sarah has disappeared, and it turns out that Sarah has retreated to an office that was being used as a dressing room, and she's sobbing. And Bess Abel says, what's wrong? What's wrong? Are you all right? And she goes, no, I'm fine. This is one of the most wonderful evenings of my life. 20 years ago when I came to Washington, D.C., I couldn't get a hotel room. And tonight I sang in the White House and danced with the president. So for her, I think it was one of these moments of, I've arrived, because she'd arrived before that, but
right.
Just kind of one of those very emotional, touching moments for her to realize, I've come a long way.
Yeah. Absolutely, that things have finally started changing the way they need to change, and that she's recognized for the incredible talent that she has. That transcends not only her gender, but also transcends race.
Yeah.
One of the early critics that was a huge fan of hers, who ended up being a host of the Today Show, Dave Garraway, you have these wonderful passages, him describing what her voice is like.
Yeah.
These are words that would not normally have been said about a black woman singer in those days, especially by a white commentator.
When Sarah Vaughan is still struggling as a solo act in 1946, 1947, she's just starting to release some records. One of her earliest and most vocal, enthusiastic supporters is a DJ named Dave Garraway in Chicago, and he starts playing her records all the time. And even though he's based in Chicago, he's a DJ for the NBC Chicago affiliate. His station actually has a pretty broad national, Eastern Seaboard kind of reach. So he's telling audiences throughout much of the country about this amazing new singer he's found. And he was talking about her voice in a way that really defied expectations. At that time, there was often, black singers were often described as having earthy, throaty voices, kind of an allusion to the blues. Mm-hmm. And here he's talking about her voice, just being astoundingly beautiful. It's like glistening little gold sparkles in it, and ephemeral. And he's just using this very vivid, very warm, beautiful language to describe her voice that's really defying a lot of the categories and stereotypes about how voices were imagined at that time. And he helps make her enormous. He basically helps jumpstart her national career in 1947.
It's a great story. Sadly enough, Sarah did not have much luck with men. She seemed to time and again marry guys and then put them in charge of her money, and they ran off with her money.
So Sarah Vaughan's, unfortunately, her romantic life was often fraught and tumultuous. She did have 5 long-term romantic partners, 3 of which she married. And unfortunately, she often installed these men in her life also as her manager. And even if they didn't have a lot of experience in the music industry, and unfortunately, many of these relationships ended up being abusive, financially, physically, emotionally. In fact, the vocalist Billy Eckstine often referred to her husband managers as damagers. Mm-hmm. So I have to confess, when I was writing this about her relationships and her romantic life in the book, that was one of the hardest things for me to do, because it was difficult for me understanding and learning more about the abuse she experienced. But I also didn't want to victimize her again. I think it's easy to be a little dismissive and say, she had terrible taste in men, which at some level is true, but I think it could be a little bit more complicated than that. I think we need to remember some basic logistics going on here. She's a musician who's sometimes touring 50 weeks a year. It's really hard to find eligible men and then cultivate relationships with them. And also, I came to understand that there was a tension between Sarah Vaughan's worldview, her ideal of what a marriage would be of equals, and what society still expected of her. Mm-hmm. We need to remember that in post-war America, gender, there lots of emphasis on traditional gender roles. Women are expected to be housewives and homemakers and mothers. And Sarah Vaughan, she just didn't fit that bill. She was a successful, very powerful professional woman. She was the primary breadwinner in her home, and often the men in her life who were still kind of living in, with traditional notions of masculinity, and like they should be the breadwinner in the home.
Right.
So this would they were kind of delegated to the role of Mr. Sarah Vaughan, and I think that was really difficult for them. So I think this created a lot of tension, a lot of conflict in her relationships. And when I think about Sarah Vaughan, there's part of me that thinks that she was actually a little bit ahead of her time when it came to her ideal of what a marriage should be, and the men in her life often were struggling to keep up with that.
She did become a mom. She adopted a daughter, and that was a wonderful relationship that she had. Many of the guys she married were musicians, and I can say, and these are people that you're playing with all the time, that sometimes that just doesn't work either.
I think it would have been hard under the best of circumstances, being a professional woman in her role, to find a good romantic match.
I guess it's just part of being kind of born romantics that we want her to have a happily ever after in her story, and that didn't happen in that particular instance. But she had this incredible career, incredible life. I love there was one thing you said about the title of your book, which I found interesting too. You said she never would have wanted the book to be named Queen of Bebop because she believed she was much more than just a bebop singer, and she was.
Oh, yes.
But it's catchy.
Yes, it is. Well, I think, so one of the wonderful things about Sarah Vaughan is that throughout her career and her life, really, she really hated labels and being categorized or pigeonholed. She understood that when you're labeled, you're constrained, and that creates a whole set of expectations about what the audience thinks you should do. And she didn't want to have anything to do with that. She wanted to sing her own way and have her own artistic vision. That said, a title like Queen of Bebop, so I think she would have been proud of being considered part of this bebop movement, which she was.
Certainly.
But there were so many other aspects of who she was as a musician. At the same time, I do believe that a lot of her approach to making music and her worldviews, like, for example, this kind of insistence on not being labeled or pigeonholed, I do believe a lot of that was developed in those early years that she associated with the other bebop musicians.
Yeah, that's kind of a bebop sensitivity, isn't it?
I think a lot of her worldview was developed during those years.
Yeah, it was an incredible time in music.
I know.
Elaine, thank you so much. This is a terrific book. Enjoyed it so much. As a musician, I enjoyed it a lot, but you don't have to be a musician to enjoy reading about a great musician, and Sarah Vaughan certainly was a great musician. Thank you so much for a great book and for taking time to talk to us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Our thanks again to our guest, Elaine Hayes, the author of Queen of Bebop, The Musical Lives of Sarah Vaughan from Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. You can check her website, elainemhayes.com. Or you can go to the Facebook page that she set up for Queen of Bebop. Like that page, and you'll see that's where all the action is. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Bookshelf. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks so much for listening, and God bless.